comments made on ZeroTalk Tech Chats are those of the individuals and do not represent ZeroTech Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers. Welcome to the latest ZeroTalk Tech Chat, powered by Accessible Event, a product of ZeroTech Corporation, giving the blind, deaf, and deafblind full access to classes, meetings, and webinars using Microsoft Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint slides, and web pages. 508 compliance is just one click away at www.accessibleevent.com. And now, here's your host, Michael Loft. And welcome to ZeroTalk Tech Chat 92, this month in access technology for February 2011. This is Michael Loft. Tonight, our guests, some of the big names in podcasting, are joining us tonight. First, the big R, Randy Rusnak with Accessible Devices. Hello, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Hi there. Greetings, everybody. Thanks for having me.
Also here is Dr. Robert Carter with the Tech Doctor podcast.
Hello, everybody, and thanks for having me, Michael.
Oh, I always love to have you here. And you've been with us before, Steve Sawson, with the Assistive Technology Show. Our Tech Chats is live Wednesday evenings from 7 to 9 p.m. Of course, it uses the Ventrilo voice chat technology.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Well, always a pleasure, sir. And I want to mention, coming up next week, March 10, we're going to talk about the new offering from Code Factory, adding some accessibility to some Android phones running 2.1, 2.2, and 2.3, and 2.32, no mention of 3 at this point, so we'll say 2.1 or later, but that's costing 69 euros or about 95 U.S. dollars. We're going to have a pre-recorded interview with Code Factory, as well as three people who have been playing around extensively and can tell us what it does, so adding better support for web browsing and SMS, and they'll give us their 6 cents combined, and we'll be talking about that next week. Well, tonight we're covering some of the big issues of February, and I guess we'll dip into March just a little bit and talk about a couple of things. RFB&D has launched a new app for iOS for $19.95, making their books accessible via that portal, and I've heard some good things about it, including the ability to speed up the books, which many of us blind folks do enjoy. Also yesterday, there was an announcement of the next-gen iPad 2.0, as they're calling it, and beefing up the processor a little bit and the graphics, although it's the same resolution. Still unsure, I ask you, Steve or Robert, still unsure about the RAM and the actual megapixel capabilities of the cameras. Have you heard anything concrete about that? One place I read it, the RAM did go up from 256 to 512. I don't know if that's confirmed or if we even know what the new front and rear-facing cameras are capable of.
Seems pretty vague. The information that I've seen has been pretty conflicting on those points. I'm hoping it has gone up. It had gone up in the iPhone 4, and it would seem logical that it would go up in the iPad, if only to match the iPhone 4. But, of course, that's just my thought, and I don't know that it's Apple's thinking.
I've heard rumors to that, Steve, that they would be close to the iPhone 4. You know, who knows, though?
Well, it's just interesting that stuff's not mentioned in the actual event. I mean, you think if there were any improvements, they would be touting them, unless, for example, maybe it was 512 and they had reason to believe someone was coming out with a gig, or I don't know why they wouldn't mention those facts, either unless there was nothing to offer or they didn't think it important. I don't know, but it seems like the RAM and that would have been mentioned.
Unfortunately, a lot of times Apple doesn't mention specs like that, and so we don't find out until later on sometimes.
Well, I know they don't mention the megapixels, but usually they do mention RAM increases, my recollection from other events. But anyway, do any of you either own a current iPad or thinking about getting the new iPad 2?
I own a current one. I am not going to get the iPad 2. I think the camera would be neat. You can do FaceTime and Skype and things like that, but I don't know. I just don't see a lot of advantages over the current iPad. If you already have an iPad, I just don't see a lot of advantages to upgrading.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. My wife actually has an iPad that we got her back in September, October, and I'm sure that of course, I never get a chance to touch it, but I'm sure there's going to be no upgrade to 2. I just can't justify it, even though I guess in some ways the cameras would be nice and the faster processor and maybe the better graphics would be nice. And it's thinner, but still, I just can't see that it really would be justified to do it.
Robert, you're supposed to own it and pawn it off on your significant other and get the latest and greatest. But
Yeah, that's yes, I did it all wrong.
That's what I did with my iPhone 3. Terry now has that, and I've got the 4. We are going to be doing that at work, though. We are going to be getting the second generation at work.
Let me mute that speech so folks don't hear that. But I guess before we get into all the techie stuff, I wanted to talk about something that I wasn't even aware of until putting together my most recent podcast. But a number of lawsuits have been recently filed. First, Delta Airlines fined $2 million for violations going back to 07 and 08 for not assisting passengers getting on and off the plane. And now blind folks are suing United Airlines. There's also an accessibility lawsuit against JetBlue Airways, basically having two main issues, and that's the inability to use the kiosks to check in, but also some inaccessibility to the websites, claiming 4 of the top 10 airlines' websites are inaccessible, which brings up one question of, A, how much of that, I mean, is that across the board? Does it have to do with particular screen readers? But I guess the question I want to ask each of the three of you is, and I'm, you know, if all of you fly much, but do you think that lawsuits are necessary, or do you think maybe there's other ways we should be approaching it? Who wants to put in their 2 cents on that one? Steve, you fly a bit, I know, so maybe you have a thought about that. Just the kiosks or ordering your tickets? Do you use third parties like Travelocity or Expedia, or how does that work for you?
Well, I would love to be able to use the kiosks. I often find that I'm not near a printer or don't have access to a printer and can't print the boarding passes, so it would be very convenient to be able to print them off the kiosk. As far as the rest of it, I've never had issues with the sites.
Yeah, I don't know really what to say about the sites themselves. I thought they were, most of them were fairly accessible, although I've mostly used Southwest site, which is pretty accessible. I don't know too much about the other sites, but I do know that the kiosk issue is an important one. And whether or not this had to come down to lawsuits, I'm not sure, but it sure sounds like, at least in some cases, maybe Delta's case, really, there had been quite a lag time there where people had filed complaints and nothing had been done about it. So, you know, maybe it did come down to that being necessary.
One of the problems I think these airlines often face is that the staff that assists people in the airports with getting on and off the flights and that sort of stuff, often that's contracted staff. They aren't necessarily employees of the airline, and they're sort of at the mercy of the availability of people that the airport is providing, or some agency that's contracting to the airport to provide those services. And that certainly isn't an excuse, but I try to see it from their point of view, in that I think they're also very frustrated, but the only thing they can really do is complain to the airport. And I think the reason that those folks don't work necessarily for the airlines is because often people need to transfer between airlines or from one terminal to another, and it would be hard for United to have folks to assist passengers who want to go from United to, say, a JetBlue flight or something like that, and then, you know, or do you hand off to another assistant, you know, that works for JetBlue, or how do you manage that? So they have these sort of airline-independent people at the airports, but I think that causes other issues in terms of managing.
Well, I think it's ultimately up to the airline to get, you know, either assist the person in boarding or deplaning, and right, then you're handed off to someone in the airport to assist you in getting to your other gate, or if you're leaving the airport, to go from there. But yes, some interesting and good comments you have there. It'll be interesting to see where all of this goes. They want access to the kiosks, and we say, well, what is the technology to make that happen? I guess, is some of this, you think, spurred? Because, well, Apple has proven that touch screens can now be used, and I've always wondered if that would be a real market for Apple to go in and retrofit kiosks or make special ones and go, look, we can build you something and take care of this issue and make it go away for you.
I think it'd be fantastic. What I'm really curious about is the accessibility of the websites. I have booked on United, and I've never had an issue with it. I know oftentimes I hear people claiming that a site is inaccessible, and oftentimes it's just because they're not sure how to interact with it, not that the site itself is inaccessible. You can book through third-party sites like Travelocity and Orbitz and things like that, but the problem is there are sometimes deals that are only available on the airline site specifically. So they're referring to an alternative site sometimes doesn't provide a solution if you need to get something, you know, that's only available on the United site or on the JetBlue page.
Well, then we also see a lawsuit against Disney claiming that certain components of the website, Flash-based content, and even access to hotels are not in Disney, saying, well, we don't have to serve, we have no obligation to serve the blind community as a group. We'll deal with it on a case-by-case basis. Any thoughts on that stance?
Well, I think the tone is really disturbing to me, because I think more and more, it seems like in 2011, we're seeing these, some of them very large companies, make statements like that, which certainly fly in the face of what I had grown accustomed to thinking, that there were laws and requirements that companies were expected to fulfill. And now with, you know, Microsoft Windows 7 just proclaiming loudly, no accessibility at this point, we don't know if and when it's coming, and issues with Disney, on and on and on, Disney bouncing back and saying we don't have to do it. It's very perplexing and very confusing to me, honestly.
Well, I want to go back to Steve's very good point that he has no issue, so we don't know at what point it's an issue of the particular screen reader being used and which cases it's an issue of a user's not having sufficient knowledge of using their screen reader or just internet navigation in general. And I just wonder if that'll ever become an issue, that they'll come back and, you know, say, well, it works with this screen reader, you just need to buy this one, because it doesn't matter. Or if they say, well, it works with VoiceOver, but nothing in Windows, so just go get a Mac, or only works with JAWS, or only works with System Access. So I just wonder if that will ever become an issue, or if someday someone will wise up and attorneys will go, well, let's look at the technology out there and then find if it works with any one of these technologies that it should be covered. I'd just be curious to see if that ever happens and how that would hold up, or if it could ever come back and say, hey, you know, I wonder if someone will ever sue a screen reader manufacturer to say, you need to put in ARIA or AJAX or UI automation to make these new sites accessible.
Take a pretty savvy lawyer to dig that deeply and understand the nuances of that. But I bet somebody will. Go ahead, Randy. I'm sorry.
I have a friend of mine that works for Disney. And as far as I know, and I want to stick my neck out here, but as far as I know, he doesn't seem to have any issues that I'm aware of. And I wish she were here to comment on that right now. As a matter of fact, at some point I'm going to ask him, and I could get back to you on that. But he's very into working with the folks at Disney, and I'd like to find out from him what he might know. You might be right, Michael. It may be a screen reader issue that many people don't have the knowledge to work with their particular screen reader that they're using. Because I tell people all the time, know your screen reader. If you don't, you're going to find yourself meeting a lot of inaccessibility issues.
Or if they're using, you know, what browser are they using? Are they using an old version of IE? Or they're using Firefox because someone told them to do so?
Well, a lot of the clients that I work with, too, are working with really, really old technology, you know, like JAWS 5 and IE 6. And it's pretty bad, pretty sad out there sometimes.
Great point. People could use it if they just had current access technology or the latest versions of browsers and things of that sort.
It's possible. Yep.
Well, there are blind lawyers, so I would see someone taking that. Go ahead, Robert.
Well, it's getting more and more complicated for the blind person also, because some screen readers work with some sites better than others, and some work with various applications better than others. And so, you know, a blind man or woman now just about has to have 2-3 screen readers in some cases to get the job done. And for a lot of us, that's just more screen readers than we have time or energy or interest in learning. So, I mean, it's the whole issue seems convoluted to me right now.
Agreed. All very good points being made here. Let's talk about Facebook. Again, just constant changes upsetting not only the blind community, but the sighted community as well. They're just on a kick of evolution, and people are getting locked out and just a whole wealth of issues. So one of the things we talked about in the podcast was because of all of the issues in the Middle East here, Libya, and so forth, that should Facebook allow anonymous postings so that people feel secure in exposing problems with their government? Of course, my view is that that defeats the whole purpose of Facebook, is that everyone being accountable, a real person, real people communicating with others, so anyone can comment on that if they want. But really, I guess the big thing I want to ask is, how should we be advocating for better access to Facebook? Do we know of efforts kind of going on? We've seen a few petitions at different times, but do we know if anyone really has ongoing dialogue, or if they basically said they don't care, or would it, because of the terms of numbers of people involved, would that be something that someone would either take into a court situation, or thoughts there?
I think one of the problems with Facebook is, and this is a pervasive problem with all web pages, is that there really is no legislation governing the accessibility of websites. There has been talk from the Department of Justice about trying to extend the 1988 ADA legislation to encompass web pages, especially those that are specifically those that are business sites. And we see to a degree that happening with the Telecom Act that was just passed that now requires a lot more online video content to be closed captioned for the deaf. And so, if we're going that direction and we're starting to look at websites and legislation that governs them, what do we need to have in place for accessibility for the blind? It's hard to really say to Facebook, though, that you have to do this because it's a good thing to do. I think we need to, and we need to keep complaining to them in a nice way and explain that, you know, hey, we are a very viable community out here, and we do want to have access, and we want to use the services, and we benefit from it. And I think if we do that in mass, we can get results. What I think a lot of the complaints are is just that, complaints. You know, your site doesn't work for me. This is not good, and blah, 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 blah. Not constructive, but just anger. And I think they don't necessarily want to respond to that. I actually have gotten emails from them when I've mentioned a couple of accessibility issues with the iPhone app. Some of them have been resolved, a lot of them haven't, but I was surprised that I actually got messages back from an actual human that I had not expected. And I know their mobile site was inaccessible for a couple of days, and they managed to get that fixed pretty quickly. So I think they want to do it, but on the other side of the coin, Facebook employs a lot of technologies that are pretty complex, a lot of Ajax, and there's a lot of stuff changing and updating and a lot of things happening on those Facebook pages, and it really is cutting-edge technology that proves challenging to make work in browsers to begin with, and then to make them accessible kind of adds another layer of complexity to it. And I think, I'm guessing that they possibly have an issue trying to figure out how to make that all happen, given that they are trying to be as cutting edge as they possibly can be, probably too much so, to a degree.
Now, when I got my first iMac about 2 years ago, I noticed the Mac and VoiceOver and Safari had an edge on all of the Windows-based screen readers as far as navigating Facebook. How is that today?
I think that's still the case. I find my results are better, although admittedly I use the mobile site more than I do the regular one, in part because there's no Farmville stuff on it. But you know, I mean, that's more of a personal preference thing. From an access point of view, the main site works fairly well with Safari. But as much as I like the Mac and I like Safari, the reality is most people are not using it. Most people are still on Windows and will still be on Windows. And that's the demographic they really have to address, I think.
Anything else there before we go on to Apple news? I know you're allowed to talk about the Apple stuff.
I agree with you about the anonymous posting. I don't think they should do that. There's other forums where you can anonymously post, and I think, although it, you know, I don't know, I can just see it being used the wrong way, people getting on some soapbox or something or other that they just want to be anonymous about and using it for those purposes versus, you know, the potential positives that you mentioned.
Well, there's already...
I've been quiet because I don't use Facebook, partly because of my being in psychology and not wanting to be contacted. But the other reason is because of the accessibility issues, and I've never really thought it would be that much fun to hassle with. And so I don't know, you know, maybe I'm missing out, but I can't help but wonder if there are a lot of reasonably tech savvy people like myself who are blind who don't use Facebook for some of those reasons.
That is part of it with me, where my use is limited. I do want to be in that space, but it has really kept me from really going out and adding friends and getting involved in groups and other things. So I only have like 43 friends in that space. Someone was going to say something.
Oh, it was just me. I was going to say that I use the mobile end of it, and I really would like to teach it because I get a lot of people that come through my work, and they ask, you know, they ask if I teach in a, you know, the social networking end of it, and some of it, you know, it's just too difficult.
Yeah, I'll certainly have a few questions for you, Randy, shortly in that space of just teaching others and some of the issues you're dealing with.
Sure.
On the iPhone front, there's been some rumors of three different prototypes of the version 5, and one of them says that it might include a slide-out keyboard. And I'm curious, would that motivate you to upgrade to that? Is that something you'd actually like to have in it, or would you rather have your own external Bluetooth and still use the touchscreen as it is?
I don't buy the rumor. I don't think Apple's going to come out with a slide-out keyboard. And even if they did, I've never seen a slide-out keyboard that was particularly easy to type on. I think I'd just about rather have the touchscreen.
Yeah, I like my Apple keyboard.
Yeah, I like my keyboard, but it's a little large. And I know there are some that they've come out with that are about the size of the iPhone, but they're kind of clunky from what I've been told. I mean, that seems like a great idea, something small and integrates into it, and you have the capability to work with that. But I'm just curious if that would sway you one way or the other. You're right. It may not be something they would ever do. It certainly would defy the logic that they currently seem to have about, you know, less buttons, less controls, controls fail, and, you know, degrade the reliability of the device.
I would be swayed. I could be.
I could be, too. I mean, I would love to see it. But, I mean, you know, Apple is a little different from, you know, in the day, you know, there was more of an elitist, here, we're going to do it this way, and we really don't care how much we sell. But Apple is driven. They're doing very well, and they are looking at the market. So certainly they had to take into account how many people have bought, and I'm sure they have ways of seeing the number of people that are actually interfacing Bluetooth keyboards with their device to say, well, hey, maybe we underestimated this capability. They're hardcore texters and, you know, people wanting to do things that need the keyboard for that purpose.
Well, what's really nice is a Braille keyboard. I've got a little BrailleSense on hand, which is a very small Braille device, and I connect it via Bluetooth with the iPhone, and then I've got this little, you know, the little Braille keyboard that is very usable with the iPhone, and boy, that's I like that better than a slide out, I think.
So, do any of you plan to switch to Verizon?
Not me. It's terrible coverage in my area.
No, I wouldn't switch either.
If I could get out of my contract, I might. I would love to switch. I did get two Bluetooth cases. There's a couple of companies now making cases that you can put your iPhone in, and they have a slide-out Bluetooth keyboard. So it still connects via Bluetooth, but since it's kind of part of the case, it's really integrated. And I've spent probably way too much money buying two of them. The reality is now I don't use either one. So, I mean, it would have to be depend on how the keyboard was designed, but I think there could be a need for it.
You don't like them because they're too clunky? Is that the reason?
Well, the one is too clunky. It like triples the thickness of the iPhone, which, you know, is okay. And it keeps forgetting that it was paired, and I have to repair it again each time. And it's like, and you don't know that until you go to type something, and then it doesn't work, so you have to go pair it. And then I think, you know, by the time I did this, I could have just used the touchscreen. The other one, I like the design, but it doesn't fit in any of the docks because it's too thick. And the keys are really, really, really tiny, which I guess, you know, depends on how big your hands are. Mine are big, so I have a hard time with those keys, and I would with any small keyboard device like that. But the keys are just really, really small. Other than that, though, it's fantastic. So, I mean, there are options out there, but I don't know. I think they're sort of hit and miss.
So do you
see that's my concern about this a slide out keyboard. I'm afraid that it would just be about too small to use.
Yeah, you'd have to certainly compromise. There would be some kind of FN with a lot of you know, do duplistic? I don't know.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Doubly functional keys there. So just on one more thought on the Verizon. Do you think we now have true competition, or really is it same-o? Do you think it really matters? Are we really going to save anything in terms of price? Maybe we'll get some features. Maybe we'll get tethering from AT&T and maybe a little more bandwidth. But I don't know. You really think we're going to save any money? What's the real benefit to us?
Doesn't matter, because really both carriers are into more into making money than anything else. And so when one, you know, neither of them are going to lower their price.
Yeah, I would say that's a given. And someone, one of my friends always said that for true competition, you need at least three entities. And, you know, I guess he always gives the Democrat and Republican parties as one of his examples, but AT&T, Verizon certainly could be another one, that you really need that third element, because otherwise you end up with price fixing. They both agree we're going to charge this much for data, this much for voice, and, you know, maybe you have some coverage in some new places. What about, I had this later, but maybe this is a good time to mention, did any of you read this thing about a patent that Apple has that would basically allow the carriers to bid? You would basically get a phone, and instead of it already being tied to a carrier, it would show you available carriers in your area, which would allow Apple to get a piece of the pie or make them bid. You know, if the phone supports both GSM and CDMA, that it would say, hey, you have your choice of AT&T or Verizon. And so they actually have to bid a little bit for your business. And, of course, Apple gets a little cut in the middle all the while. What are your thoughts on that?
It's just getting so crazy out there. I get people that come in and ask me, well, what phone should I buy? What carrier should I go with? And it used to be a once-a-month issue, and now it's just about every day. And if it goes that way, I'm leaving the technology field, I think.
Well, I'm very much a pro-choice kind of guy, yes. I'd say let's do it that way. Let's buy the phone and let us choose the carrier. I like it a lot.
Oh, I like it too, but it's going to cause a lot of issues, I think.
Well, if they do follow through and come out with a less expensive phone to compete with some of the Android units and their increasing share of the marketplace, and you do actually get a phone for $200 and you can then choose which carrier it goes with, and then the carrier either subsidizes it based on a contract, or like I said, Apple, it would make sense. Well, I'll put them right in the middle to get a little commission. It'll be very interesting to see if this comes to pass. Well, here's one I know you're going to love. Let's talk about new iPhone apps. We talked about this a couple months ago, but I have a story here, first off, I guess, from LockerGnome.com about five free GPS apps. And I'll be curious to see if any of you have been playing with these, looking at some alternate GPS technologies, or kind of what you're doing, if anything, in that space.
I'm not really doing anything. I've got Navigon on my phone, and but I'm really involved with the Sendero Group GPS devices, and with the HIMS Sense Nav. And if you have access to some of those, they're really, really hard to beat. But if you don't have access to them, I think some of the iPhone GPS apps are really quite good for what we need them for. Not as good, but you know, people are really getting a lot of good use out of them.
I was excited. Some of our members on SamNet said that at least two of the apps of the five mentioned in this LockerGnome article, unfortunately, doing a redirect through bit.ly, gave me a page not found, so I can't post this. We will go get the direct URL and update the show notes with that. But so there are some options in that space. Anyone else doing anything beyond Navigon? No?
Doesn't seem like it.
Okay. Well, we'll move on then. What about the RFBND app that was just released, $19.95, giving access to their content? Do any of you use RFBND, or would this motivate you to maybe go back and look at some of the unique content that they've put together? Randy, have you been playing with it?
I have not been playing with the app. I do use their website on occasion and do attempt to teach it with some. I don't really want to go into their site. Let's just say that I don't care for their site much.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, if this is a better interface, because their site, and it does this multi 200, 300 part downloads, like some kind of torrent.
Oh,
or
God.
It's the most awful UI I've seen, and there's so much potential for things to go wrong. But a few folks have said they really like the new iOS method. Robert, have you played with it? Anyone in here?
I actually haven't played with it, but I do understand that they they came out with a new downloader, which is different from what they've had before, which apparently puts the entire book into one zip file so that you can copy that directly onto your iOS device for the app. I am, you know, a bit concerned about, apparently this app does unzip these files on your device, and I'm thinking that it wouldn't take long to get your device pretty full, because these books are pretty good size once they're unzipped. And so I don't know how that really would work out, or how many books people would want to carry around on their device. I did hear a demo of it. Corey did one on all with my iPhone, and it seemed to work pretty well.
Well, have any of you played with the new Google Translation app?
I have not.
You know, you mentioned the RFBND app. I haven't played with it yet, but there's been sort of some interesting conversation on Twitter about the fact that they're charging for that app. And I, of course, have opinions on that subject, like I do everything. But there's a couple of folks who are saying that they feel it's not fair that RFBND is charging, I think it's $20 for that particular app, given that they don't charge for, or they no longer charge for keys if you have a device, you know, and you want a key for, say, a Victor Stream or something, and for the website. So that this seems odd that they would charge for this sort of access. I disagreed with that at first, but now that I'm thinking about it a little bit, I don't know. It is a little bit strange that they're specifically charging for this application.
Maybe well, only bit, the fact it's, that it's they're a, charging... Go ahead.
It's a bit odd because they don't charge for keys for devices, but they do charge they have now a player for to run on Windows PCs and a player that runs on the Mac, and they will let you have one of them at no charge. But if you want the other one, if you want both of them, you have to pay $20 a year for the second one, in other words. And the Mac application doesn't have yet all of the features of the Windows application, even though they say they're coming. With the Mac app, for example, you can't speed up the reading of the text, which, of course, you can do on the iOS app and on the Windows app. But I don't know. The whole thing just seems awfully inconsistent to me, and I don't quite understand the plan. When I talked to them about it, they just said, well, we have to do it this way, we have to charge like this because it's what the publishers demand. And so I don't know. That's all the information I got.
Well, I can buy that. I'm more of it would make sense to me that they would want to recoup. Maybe they spent $5,000-$10,000 building the app and they need to recoup the cost of software development. But to say it's the publishers, that doesn't quite make sense.
Didn't really make sense to me.
I can see if it were someone like Bookshare, because they have a licensed, they'll have to license their speech engines. But I can't see it from RFBND. But I don't expect everything to be handed to me either.
Well, that was my thought, is that, you know, I get their point, and you know, I probably shouldn't have reacted the way I did on Twitter, but I think to myself, geez, it's $20, and that's a heck of a lot cheaper than any of the books I'm going to read with it. I mean, if I have to buy the books that I would read in that app, I'm going to pay probably three times that per book.
Exactly.
You know, especially students and that sort of stuff, textbooks and whatever. I think it's fantastic that students have this possibility. It's a great day to be a student, I think,
Yeah, Steve, wouldn't it have been fabulous to have had that when we were in school, to be able to carry your RFBND books around on an app, on your phone, instead of on a reel-to-reel cassette, a reel-to-reel tape?
Reel-to-reel, or later even those tan APH kind of machines that worked fantastic but weighed about 1,000 pounds, and just the ability to be able to find things quickly is just... I feel so old thinking, these kids don't know how easy they have it, but, there's a lot of truth in that. Plus, it's a mainstream device. You don't look like you know, a blind freak using some specialized device. You're using an iPod or an iPhone or an iPad even that everyone else is using. You know, it's a mainstream thing. People don't look at you and say, you know, what is that thing? You know, it's a mainstream device. So I'm happy they've done it. And the controversy over the price of it, I think, is interesting. But either way, I think it's fantastic. And in the greater scheme of things, to have access to their library, I'd gladly pay that money.
I agree with you, this whole concept of the screenless note takers and portable devices that have no screen. Others say, well, it shouldn't matter. We got to use, you know, what we want to use. But you've got to think about that. You're setting up the precedent with your students for interactions. They're going to need, some of these folks are going to go on and be employers, and they're going to say, well, okay, yeah, I went to college with this blind guy or this lady, and she did okay, I guess, but she had these proprietary technologies, and so she can't use whatever the rest of us in our company use, so I really don't think I'm going to hire them. And I think people underestimate that. Because that'd be going to debate. All right, send the email now. Blast me.
Well, I see a place for them, but I don't get asked to see them, if that makes sense. They would rather see other devices rather than the proprietary devices.
Well, since you brought a book, so are any of you using the Kindle for PC app? And what about this thing about converting books to HTML? Have any of you done that? Is that working?
Yes and yes.
Right, same here. I use the app. When I found out it was accessible, I think I started working with it the next day, or at least the next couple of days after, with one of my students, as a matter of fact, and he was all keyed for it. There are a lot of things that I wish it would do a little differently, but still, it's a first step. But I do not want to be tethered to my PC.
Well, exactly. So, you know, we can convert them to HTML, but again, it's something that. And what about these, you know, you have Florida, you have a new school district in Missouri, they're going to basically insist all their students are going to start using portable Kindle devices. And this reminds me of Stephen, your whole initiative when they were ready to hand out Apples to all students, or K-6 or whatever it was, or junior high and high school, whatever the situation was in Maine, that you said, hey, we need to get involved. If they're going to hand out a piece of hardware, that device needs to be fully accessible. Likewise, even the Kindle PC, we need, you know, we're going to use this for, not just for students, but all of us. We need the ability to navigate. We need to be able to spell words and move character by character and see how things are spelled.
Yeah, I'd say the PC app is marginally accessible. I mean, yes, you can read a book, but you're really limited in what you can do with it. And even the process of converting to HTML, I have had mixed success with it. I've converted maybe four or five books, and three of them have worked quite well, and two of them, the HTML that I got just didn't work in any reasonable manner, any browser that I tried it in. And so, plus the other thing is there aren't that many people who are going to spend the time learning to use all these various conversion tools and going through this process. It isn't terribly complicated once you've done it a time or two, but it's not one click and it's done either.
Well, earlier we mentioned the 21st Century Communications Act, and it looks like today the FCC threw out some new guidelines as far as mandates, if you will, or some rules for networks and television stations making described video content available again. How do any of you feel about that? Do you think that should be the case, or do you like when they say things like, yeah, the top 25 markets, but everyone else who lives in rural Maine or Indiana or I don't know, is Minneapolis even in the top 25? Folks say, well, sorry, you're not top 25. So I don't know. I'm one of those all or nothing people. What do you think about that? Or should we be more concerned with things like the emergency alert system so that we find out when severe weather is approaching and be able to read those texts that scroll across the bottom of the screen? Any thoughts on that?
I think the severe weather alerts are a big thing. I think we need to have access to those. I know there's radios that you can get that give you that information, and there's other ways to get it, but, you know, you don't always have that stuff, and you may not have it with you, and that sort of thing, and that just seems critical. I mean, your life might depend on it. The described audio is nice for people that like that sort of stuff, and it would make, I think, TV watching a much more enjoyable experience. but you're not going to die if you miss it. And I don't know. I just think the priority needs to be on the emergency alert stuff. Having said that, though, if they go the route of descriptive audio, I think they should just do it. I mean, if they're doing it for the top 25 markets, they may as well just be done with it. They're already doing it. Just extend it to the rest of them. The programming is probably more or less the same anyway, different times and whatnot, but it doesn't seem like it would be difficult to expand it to the rest of the markets.
Yeah, technically now with HD channels, they should have more flexibility and capability as opposed to in the past where they just had one, you know, third channel and they had to decide, wow, do we do DBS or do we sell it to Spanish or something, you know? But what about using TTS? There's a new survey, WGBH, asking you to give your opinions on using different voices for TTS web-based video transcribed content. How do you feel about that?
I took the survey, and I expected to be, you know, rather short, and I was sitting there for about an hour. I gladly took it. I found it interesting. I think that I probably would have. I had to take a break. I had to finish it later. I think if they do it again, I think they should shorten it up a bit. But I was happy to take it.
Yeah, it was kind of lengthy, so I don't know how many people either started and didn't finish. But hopefully, many people did. And we'll be curious to see. We've heard rumblings about it where actual content could be made available, or that could be a situation to help improve, because one of the complaints they made as far as doing this stuff for TV is some of the episodes of, you know, ongoing seasons come down to like 48 or even 24 hours before they go live. They're right down to the minute, and to actually have someone come in and do narration. So how would you feel even about TTS being on a television program or a movie?
I would think
I'd be okay with that.
Yeah.
I'd be okay with it.
I think it could be done quicker, obviously.
Yeah.
Right, and they could use HTML5 or some kind of synchronization technology and just plug it in the appropriate places. Although, of course, I guess we could have issues of the text-to-speech overlapping with the dialogue and people getting confused and, you know, what? But
I realize it's all personal preference, but I have this fear that Samantha is going to be narrating.
Yeah.
I do wonder what it would be like, you know, if you were wanting to watch these shows with family members or sighted people. I wonder if it would be really distracting for them, or if there'd be some way to separate it out and only you hear the TTS information. I don't know. It's kind of an intriguing idea.
But I'm excited about the fact that you could use this to actually watch or listen to something along with sighted folks so they could share the experience. There was some testing, I think, even, you know, with the 24/7 channel in Canada where even sighted folks could actually listen to the narration and do other things, you know, do housework or cook, and actually use that to tell what was going on the screen, and we're content with that. So who would have thought?
I understand what you mean. I do, but people that I know, I think it would drive them crazy. I really do. I don't think anybody that, at least that I know, would.
Well, the TTS would drive them crazy. God, I remember
exactly.
My ex-wife. I mean, she used to go nuts with my TTS eloquence going at 500 words a minute. Drove her nuts.
Yeah. Another thing, if we get like Karen on there as a descriptive video, I think I could hear somebody saying to me, I don't think we should use that voice. I don't think we should hear that.
Oh, I totally think we should use that voice.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Karen for all.
Karen for all.
We all have subjective opinions on our speech engines, but we all like Karen, don't we? I think for the most part.
Well, I tried her on the iPhone, though, and I went back because there was too many weird pronunciations that I wasn't used to.
I still kept her. I have her today.
Keep her for about a week, Michael, and you'll be fine.
Yeah. Oh,
okay, so I just need to persist a little bit.
Yeah.
God loves Samantha, or God hates Samantha.
I'm still kind of worrying about Julie. I don't know. The jury's out for me on Julie. I liked her at first, but not quite sure anymore.
For sure.
Cool. Have any of you played with this IBM, this VTM voice translation manager? Sounds like a cool technology to actually transcribe voice recordings, even Skype calls. I've got to plug that in and see if it's going to work.
I've heard about it, but I haven't tried it.
Can't imagine there wouldn't be a lot of correction to do once you
Okay, Pete Bosley says we are pretty sure that the iPad camera will be the same as the iPod Touch camera. In other words, no promises of OCR there. Was that thing like 0.96 or something crazy? Yeah, Apple's totally obsessed with 720p video, but I don't know how we convince them. Maybe some folks want to do OCR, man. I don't know. Again, questions are enabled for folks who want to participate in that. A few things in the screen reader front. Of course, now we have a U.S. distributor for the Cobra screen reader. Have any of you used that, or do you even care?
I care, just because it's there, but I haven't used it. I don't even know what they're using for an engine.
But it has Eloquence and a few others as well.
Really? Okay. I wouldn't myself try to learn. Well, I shouldn't say that. I mean, there's going to be maybe somebody out there that just has to have it, so I can't say that I won't learn it, but my goodness, I'm learning so many so many screen readers right now that sometimes I forget my commands.
Well, let me ask Steve, as an AT trainer as well, and you're certainly allowed to, welcome to plug your business. If you're still doing that, you're all over the place. But do people really stick with the first screen reader they learn? And we were saying the importance now of needing two or three screen readers. How many people do you find can actually do that? Or they just lock onto JAWS or Window Eyes or System Access and don't go any further?
Well, it comes down to a couple of issues. Number one, the money. It would be great, and I think people would be wanting to use more than one screen reader. The problem is, how do you pay for it, and then have to pay for the updates for those multiple screen readers, and that's a huge issue. The other problem, of course, is the learning curve. They don't all behave the same, and the commands are all different, and for a lot of people, they're just not techies, and they just want to use the computer and do something with it and shut it off when they're done with it. And the idea that, you know, you have to use this screen reader in this situation, and if this doesn't do that, then you have to use this one, which does this, but only this way. And all of that stuff is sort of on top of what they just want to do and get done and over with. And so there are those techies, of course, that use multiple screen readers, but I think majority of folks just stick with the one that they know, either because they are unable to get another one or because they just don't want to do the whole learning curve of dealing with another one. This is shifting a little bit because of some of the free screen readers, Essay2Go and, of course, NVDA, take the, you know, you have to pay for another screen reader argument out of the equation. And so a lot of people are using those screen readers now as a backup, which is fantastic. And then that has led, in a couple of cases that I've seen, to people actually switching to that as a primary screen reader. And a recent survey shows a decline in JAWS and an increase in NVDA and System Access and VoiceOver, which is kind of an interesting trend to me. I have seen Cobra. I did play with it. It is impressive, and I can't think of where I would recommend it. It is neat, but it's, I think it would have been neat a couple of years ago if it were introduced. A lot of the features that are touted as making Cobra really revolutionary, really aren't anymore. I mean, it's not the only screen reader you can run from a thumb drive, and that's one of the things they talk about. And it's not the only screen reader that doesn't require video intercept. They're not making these claims, but those are some of the bulleted, you know, this is why you want to get Cobra. And the reality is you don't need to. Cobra's not the only way to go if that's your motivation. So it's a lot of money, and I'm still not entirely convinced that you gain a lot of stuff. Still, it's good to have options, I suppose.
Yeah, so two things on that front. One, I heard it's a little hotkey heavy, but also I heard it has a feature that can actually do like a screen scrape, basically do a snapshot of a screen, and then you could interact. So if there was a actual application piece of software that just didn't speak by default, that you could actually do a snapshot of it and then kind of navigate it and read the text. I don't know if you played with that.
I did. I was impressed with that idea. The problem is, if the text isn't text, you can't read it even if you've scraped it off the screen. This is similar. JAWS has a feature like this, a virtual window sort of feature that I know I used to use a lot of times in terminal programs, and it sort of gives you a still snapshot of the screen that you can navigate. But if the buttons in the application are not labeled or aren't accessible to begin with, or the text is imaged and is not accessible, then it's also not accessible in that frozen model of it. So it's nice to have the ability to review it, but it's really not much different than using your, well, like, for example, in System Access terms, the virtual mouse thing. I mean, you're basically doing the same thing, albeit in a frozen state. So it sounds neater than I think it really will prove to be.
Well, we see Adobe upgraded to 10.2, and someone said, no problem, here's this MSI, a Microsoft installer, and you can get it and install it yourself. But the point is, it still comes up when you reboot your computer, and it says, hey, there's a new version, and you got the Q button and the I button and the button and the...
Yep.
So what? Any thoughts on that? Are we pushing Adobe to make that work better, or do you recommend people go out and get the MSI, or... learn that Q means quit and I means install, and you can kind of guess, and maybe you'll get it the first time, maybe you'll have to do it two or three times before it actually installs.
I don't know. I haven't had any problems installing it myself. I mean, I've had to do it two or three, mostly two. Sometimes I do get it on the first time. But when I show it to someone, especially to a new screen reader user, they that confuses them even more. So,
yeah, I haven't really had any problems installing it, but I was hoping that this update flash.org would really be, a solution. But the couple times I've run it just before installing a new flash, it told me that my flash was already up to date, which it wasn't. So that was disappointing.
Well, I'd like to see maybe a screen reader flag, and it says, okay, I see you have a screen reader, so instead it gives you an option of running this MSI. Well, like I said, it's not a big deal. I mean, it has Q and I, and that made sense to me. But, it's just a bigger issue, I suppose, of just Flash in general. Let's see. We have a text question.
Well, where it is kind of a big deal, Michael, is on the Mac, because you can't really install it on the Mac without digging into the installation package and finding the installer that will talk way down in the package somewhere. And so if you don't know how to do that, it's really hard to install Flash on the Mac.
It's also a huge deal because they do claim that stuff is accessible and that they're committed to accessibility. And I mean, Adobe has even hosted conferences and symposiums and stuff on accessibility. And yet, the fact that they can't make this installer accessible, Flash does have the ability within a Flash applet to detect for the presence of assistive technology. There is an assistive technology flag, and they encourage developers to use this flag to detect. They can't tell if it's a screen reader or something else, but the fact that they don't use this, and that this isn't like the first version where this is broken. This has been broken for quite a number of versions now. People have complained about it for quite a while now, and they still haven't addressed it, and it just seems like it would be such an easy thing to fix. I mean, it's not like they're the first company ever to write an installer, and it just gives the impression that they don't care.
That's kind of the way I'm walked away with feeling. Pete Bosley points out that, or his comment, he says, Adobe is useless, but he says MSIs are available if you sign up to distribute Flash. So, but I think most of us are getting it from Adobe directly. And like I said, when you reboot the computer, it comes up, hey, update available. So I wonder then if a screen reader manufacturer could circumvent that and have an MSI pop-up. I don't know. It's something to ponder.
Probably, but if they did, it would break. So,
and then Mike Arrigo comments on the latest installer for the Mac. He said, actually, the newest is, it says it's usable, but you can't navigate the window, but you can tab to the install button. Again, Adobe. We pull our hair out. But yeah, I know what you mean. It frustrates me that they actually go and sponsor events at even blindness conventions. And, that makes it all good. Turn your heads and look the other way as we ignore accessibility on things.
I mean, they're a huge company. They must have a blind guy somewhere in that company that can test this before they release and say, hey, manager, I can't install this. And you know what I mean? It just amazes me. It's like they don't even acknowledge that it's an issue. And they must have blind employees that face this. They can't not know this.
Well, before we run out of time, I want to see if anyone has thoughts on Nokia partnering with Microsoft and using Windows Mobile 7, which is not accessible. And, of course, my N82 has been pretty much in the drawer other than using it once in a while for KNFB reader. But even the Nokia software that they were putting out during my last use, the radio app and some other stuff, would have been cool if I could have actually used it. Any thoughts on this? Should we care? Should we really be pushing buttons and making sure that accessibility is built from the ground up and not just assuming that it's going to be an Apple and Android world, and that they may take their rightful place, and we need access.
I hate to see Nokia moving in this direction, because the Symbian platform at one time was a very exciting, accessible platform, and man, it was really, there was nothing cooler at the time than what we could do with talks and mobile speak, and I hate to see that go away.
Anyone else a thought on that?
I totally agree. I think, Symbian was fantastic. It seems a shame they're abandoning it. I think we need to come down really hard on Microsoft for not addressing accessibility in Windows 7, but it's a shame to watch Nokia sort of abandoning a platform that has been very, very successful. Maybe it hasn't had a lot of traction here in the U.S., but internationally, Symbian's quite a mainstream platform, so it is sort of painful to watch it be abandoned.
Well, I got to read you this question. Wow, this is a totally different plane. It says, what do you folks think about the possibility that Microsoft could someday take accessibility out of the Windows desktop platform, since the Windows 7 or Mobile 7 platform is inaccessible to us? Anyhow, that worries me personally. Well, I don't think that's going to happen, because the government space, and I think Microsoft should be improving accessibility for Windows, because they're going to have to compete with Apple as education and government and other entities where 508 compliance comes into play. I'm not really worried about that, but do any of you have thoughts on that question, comment?
Oh, it's something to ponder. I mean, I didn't think they would take it out of Windows 7 either. I mean, you just don't know. I'd like to not worry about it, but I think this move on the part of Windows 7 shows that, you know, it does pay to worry about stuff like this, because if they do it, then we're kind of charged with fixing it or trying to prevent it.
Say, right, what if they just say, well, okay, no problem, you got Apple. We'll relinquish and let the blind community go over to Apple. But I really don't think it's that simple. I think I'm more concerned that Microsoft could say, all right, we're going to offer some accessibility to shore up our government and school systems and so forth, but be a half-baked, maybe, two steps up, two steps back narrator that is enough to say, hey, they're going to call it a screen reader, and then, that stifles innovation from the commercial screen reading entities. That would be my larger concern, actually. So either way, the question then comes back to the level of accessibility for Windows, I suppose. Let's see this question. Pete Bosley makes a good comment. He says, that's a good point, because he's talking about the new Silverlight. They said the new tablet OS is based on Silverlight, and we kind of know what we can and can't do with that. So that's, I guess, a good point. It's something I hadn't thought about. And that's, we're talking about tablets. That's the new thing right now, that they're saying that they're really downgrading the projected future or large sales of PCs, because they really believe iPad has set a trend for the tablet market, so that we now need to be concerned with access to these tablet devices. Someone asks here, Kenny asks, has there ever been a survey on how many people use two or more screen readers? I think you will find that more and more people find this for accessing computers. Well, actually, there was the recently released WebAIM, the third study, that actually goes into great detail, and we posted that via Twitter, and we would add that here to the show notes. Very interesting findings showing a drop in some of the main name screen readers, so to speak. I don't know if I say surprising, but interesting increase in the number of people opting for NVDA. And I know here in Indiana and some other states, when there's money's not to be available, they're saying, hey, just go get NVDA or go to SA2Go, because we really don't have the money to buy you anything and you don't have a job lined up. So go use those and do what you can, and have a nice day.
Now, money is getting tight, that's for sure, and I think that we're going to find that to be true. But to answer his question, I myself use four of them, so maybe,
JJ says, I don't buy the notion that Microsoft has to make Windows speak better just for 508. They haven't for the last 20 years, and they aren't losing a lot of mainstream market share. And so the blind market is still a tiny market. That's a big debate. I mean, some folks are like, well, you know, these companies should do this because we're a market. And there's a lot of other people saying, hey, we're not enough of a market. We need to look at ourselves realistically as numbers. And that's a great debate. Maybe we should get some folks who feel very strongly on both sides. That would make for a very interesting tech chat. Are we a viable market in terms of numbers? And I know people feel very, very strongly on that one. Wow, that's I think a tech chat has just been born. Kenny Ann said it's the SMA people that don't want to pay them. Well, that's true. People don't want to pay SMAs, but you know, they either have to, whether they want to or not, sometimes for reasons of employment. A smaller company like Serotech, we found that it was easier to just have everyone use the same version and actually saved us money than trying to support versions 5 through 12. So it's, I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see what the free technologies, what effect Apple has, the rumors, Windows 8, if they include improved access technology into the operating system. We hear things going both directions. It could be better, it could be worse. Wow, we're running out of time here, actually, so I want to do a final round of comments. If there's anything I haven't addressed or any final thoughts you'd like to leave us with, we'll start with you, Robert.
Well, I'm just really glad we're having that Serotech is having these chats where we can kind of talk about the past, present, and future of where things are at right now, because I think things are really changing fast, and it's good to think about these things. It had never occurred to me really until somebody raised the question, would Microsoft ever take accessibility out of its Windows product? And it is interesting to think about. So at any rate, nothing more than that other than to say thanks for having me, and I enjoyed the chat.
All right, Randy?
Yeah, I agree with Robert. I'd also like to say that there are, you know, a few tech chats, well, not tech chats per se, but, you know, there are quite a few of these talks now, and I really listen to all of them just to keep up. I think they're very important. I, for one, listen to both parts of the book cast that you did. I think they were great. I learned a lot. I'm still learning a lot. I learn every day. I'm keyed about CSUN. I'm keyed about everything. And I just want to tell you and to tell everybody at Serotech, keep up the good work, because I try to get as much information I can to keep up to date. So thanks a lot for having me on as well.
Well, we appreciate the kind words, and certainly welcome all of you, encourage all of you to listen to the great podcast that our three guests tonight host, including Accessible Devices at accessible-devices.com. Robert Carter's efforts at dr-carter.com, is it? It's not net, right? .com.
And, yes, .com.
And, of course, Steve, the assistive technology show at AT Maine is in the state, ATMAINE.com. Your final thoughts tonight, Steve?
Well, I realize we're running out of time. I want to thank you for having me on. I think these are very exciting times for all of us. There is a lot of information out there, and I think a lot of people find it a bit overwhelming. But, you know, it's great. We have a lot of options, a lot of opportunities that we never had before. And the more we have these sorts of discussions and get people involved and aware of the issues, I think the better the future is going to be for all of us. So I'm very, very excited.
What a great note to end on. And we encourage any of you who'd like to continue the discussion over in the SAMNet Tech Room can do so if you're a member of SAMNet. If not, go set up a free 7-day trial account and give it a play and come in and put in your 2 cents at www.satogo.com. And join us next week. We will dig under the hood of the new offering from Code Factory and seeing what it actually brings to the table for Android 2.1 devices and later. And of course, we'll have our next podcast on the 14th with the latest AT news. Some interesting interviews I think you will find interesting. And also our CSUN coverage, including some new tactile options for navigating the internet and using your computer, allowing you to play games and a hybrid between Braille and graphics. All kinds of good stuff coming up in the month of March. So until we meet again, stay connected and stay directed.
This concludes another Serotalk Tech Chat, powered by Accessible Event, a product of Serotech Corporation, giving the blind, deaf, and deafblind full access to classes, meetings, and webinars using Microsoft Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint slides, and web pages. 508 compliance is just one click away at www.accessibleevent.com. Until we meet again, stay connected and stay directed.